The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
In Japanese folklore, there's a legend of the Jinmu. Known as the Golden Crow, these storied objects were depicted as three-legged crows contained within fiery orbs. Early legends count 10 of these creatures that settled across 10 different suns. They were housed within a giant tree from which they would be dispatched every morning to travel across the world. Occasionally, they descended to Earth to consume a special type of grass of immortality. At one point, the legends tell of the 10 crows leaving at the same time, causing the world to burn. Total catastrophe was avoided by the great celestial archer Huyi, who struck down all but one of the destructive creatures. Could these accounts of burning orbs be seen as early interpretations of extraterrestrial UFOs? Japan's history contains perhaps another, more recent event where a small fishing village may have had a close encounter with a being not of this planet. This case file joined the theorists as they sip some sake around the Japanese campfire tale of the Utsuro Bune UFO.
Welcome to Alien Theorist Theorizing, Case File 187, Utsuro Bune UFO.
Close enough.
And the UFO stands for Unidentified Floating Object. I'm Braden.
I'm Zell.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Tiny Andrew.
You said it, well, not us. Yeah,
finally. There we go.
Back.
Finally admits
back.
It.
First step is admitting you have a problem.
Yeah. It's good.
Now, first things first, we're done with that fucking running challenge.
Fuck the challenge. It's over.
Running challenge
it's
is over.
Done.
Okay, I got to ask, Dan, have you been riding a bike this whole time or what?
No.
Dan's been trolling me with a bike ride.
There's no way you can ride a bike that slow. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. It's not a fuck, unless you're walking. Well,
I'd fall over if I rode it that slow.
Dan's a secret marathon runner, if no one knew. All of a sudden, we know.
He also didn't run for the first 20 days. He was just logging fake runs, had him private. So, just saying.
It's all running.
We had some good... the winner, again, is Mr. Zeitgeist. Absolutely crush it. So, the record for the most kilometers traveled was held by him with 488 kilometers last year. And he beat his own record. So he is the new ATT record holder for most distances logged in the running challenge with 499.18 is the official record. So last year, 2020, we had 57 participants. We logged 3,850 kilometers, and we had 9 people with over 100 kilometers logged. This year, we logged 6,038 kilometers.
Wow.
We had 115 participants. We had 20 people with over 100 kilometers logged.
Woo!
That's a fucking
People be running this year.
Congratulations to everyone who participated. You're all a little bit more fit than you were a month ago.
And a little bit sore, and your knees are probably fucked.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Well, hey, Mr. Zeitgeist in the chat, he said, damn, he didn't know he would have pushed it to make that 500. Now you got a goal for next year, buddy.
Better luck next year.
And the way Dan's moving, you know, you might have Dan to put up Dan, some numbers next year.
Let me tell you something.
Turtle versus the hare, or tortoise versus the hare, whatever the fuck it is. Zeitgeist versus Dan, 1v1.
I got to ask Dan a question. Dan, what did you play sports as a kid?
I played soccer and stuff, but not a lot. Like I didn't play sports in high school. Really.
You weren't a competitive athlete.
No, but when I was in the Navy and stuff, like you guys didn't know me before, like when I was in the Navy and stuff, like I was into lifting, like I was an athlete. Like it's not like,
well, lifting is one thing, but running is the other thing.
No, I did running too. Like I did running. I took the whole, like, you know, back when Vibrams were a thing, the five finger foot shoes or whatever.
Yeah, the toe
shoes. I was running in those. I was running five, you know, 10Ks, whatever. It's like, it's not.
I'll say this. Whatever. I was Dan. Now I will, you know, suspiciously hand over the title of the running theorist to you. You beat me this year. Congratulations. Congrats. No, it was good month. I'm going to keep running. I was hurt near the end. I couldn't really run without pain, which was a tough one. So I haven't run since the last day. I think I put on a 6K or something. But I'm going to try to keep running through the summer this year and not just wait till next April to run again, which I did. That was my strategy going into this month.
Like I'm going to take the title of top theorist in the running challenge, but not by much. And only reason is because Dan.
Oh, that's right.
Dan would run earlier than me, so I'd have to see how crazy Dan was running, and then I'd have to try and match him.
Wait. So Dan isn't the.
No, I forgot. Zell beat him with 5 minutes left before midnight. Zell went for a quick 2K to take the.
Purely running on fucking salt. That's all it was. Dude. Just a salty motherfucker putting on fucking kilometers.
Well, Dan ran 20 the last day, and I was like, oh, this motherfucker. And then so I was like, okay, well, I can run 20. And I was running. And then during the run, I just hear that in the chat, like, what the fuck, Dan? Jesus, Dan. I was like, oh, fuck, did Dan run again? I was like, well, I guess I can just stop running now. So I finished the run. I was a little bit late. Ladies all got mad. So I ended at 18K. I was like, oh, fuck. I checked. I was like, Dan's up by like 6.5K. I was like, this motherfucker's running two. He's running the last 4 days. He's running 2 days, 10K a day.
But this is after the conversation we had. Like, I put all my cards on the table at the beginning. I said the day before, we're going to do 20K. Let's go. Zell's like, no, don't do 20K. I'm like, no, we can do 20K. We can do it, man.
Don't you and do he's fucking
like,
20K.
He's like, no, you better do it all in one run. You better do it all. I better not see you because I had been running like 6-7K, like
twice a day.
In the morning and in the afternoon. I've been doing that and splitting up. And I said, okay, I'll do 20K. No problem, man. Let's go.
No problem.
And I told Zell, I was like, if you need to break it up, you can do that. Like, if you need to break it up to keep up, like, that's fine. You can do that. So I put all my, I ran 20K in the morning and then in the afternoon, I was still pretty good. I was like, all right, well, I'll run another like 7K.
Got fucking Carl Lewis over here just running his mouth.
That's the reason I had to beat Dan because he's talking.
You can break it up.
Dan was talking so much smack that I was like, well, I can't let him win.
No, good for you.
Couldn't do it.
Well, I knew Zell's the kind of person that it's like, if you put a goal in front of him, I think the best thing to come out of this is I've gotten to know Zell a little bit better. I know he'll do anything to win. And that includes waiting until the last minute to load up his last run.
I was calling him when you were ahead of him. You were ahead of him by like 0.1 or 0.2 miles. I was calling him. I was like, and shooting him texts. I was like, whatever you're doing, wake up. You have to go for a run.
I was
you
in have bed. To go.
You're so I close.
I wanted to see. I knew Zell was going to do one of two things. He was either going to wait till he thought I was asleep, and then he was going to try and beat me. He's going to wait till about midnight my time, and then he was going to go out and run about 9 p.m. Or he was going to wait until the last minute to load up his last runs. So I knew he was going to do one of those two things. in which he did both. So
it's like, you're racing against a vampire. And then I told him need to sleep,
in the group
dude.
Chat, I'm saying, oh, you know, I was like, I went out. I was at 1:30. I was still awake.
Go to bed.
I woke up for some reason. I don't know. I was like, I was actually asleep. And then I woke up and I saw a notification that Zell had run a little bit more and was up above by like 0.1. I was like, all right, let's see how bad he really wants it. Right. So I went out. I did like a quick like 0.3 kilometers, like up and down the block. Came back in, set it up. And then, like, yeah, Brayden had already called out Zell. He's like, way to go, Zell, using the time zones to screw over Dan, you know? And then I'm like, hey, it's fine. Like, it's like, I know Zell, he'll crawl out of bed if he has to do it. Brayden says he's trying to call him and I'm trying to call him and like get him to do one more run. And I was like, Zell will do it. Like, if he has to crawl out of bed, if he's got to fucking crawl that last, you know, couple kilometers, he'll fucking do it. I know he'll do it. And then we didn't hear anything from Zell, like, for an hour. Didn't hear anything from him. And then, like, at pretty much, what was it? It was probably about, like, 11:50 Pacific Standard Time. So it was, like, 3 in the morning my time. He posts his last runs and he's like, go to sleep, Dan. Right. Yeah. And it's just like, it was so funny. I was like, cause for a second I was like, man, maybe I don't know Zell as good as I thought I did. And then when he posted, I was like, nope, I know Zell just as much as I thought.
I'm in bed. I'm watching Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. And I get a text from, I hear a call. I'm like, who the fuck's calling me this late? I'm not answering it. So I don't check it. And then I check my phone, like, half an hour later, and Brayden's like, you got to go for a run. And I was
and
like,
I told him, I said, do not check the Facebook chat because then Dan will know you saw. Stay off the Facebook chat.
Oh, you can do this. So it took all of you to beat me. Oh my God. So, it took all our two Canadians powers. Couldn't even stand up.
I was going to check at 11:45 because I thought Dan might have logged the last minute. So I was,
yeah,
I was
you
prepared.
Thought I'd pull that shit. No, I put all my cards on the table. I told you guys I was going to play it fair, and I did.
Well,
you both had to conspire to win, and that's fine. I know you guys will do anything to win. So,
well, and there's props need to be fucking given out too, because one of these motherfuckers was doing 3 runs a day, one of them before work, one of them on his fucking lunch break, and one of them home.
Yeah.
I'm telling you right now, if Brayden didn't have a fucking job, I don't know, man.
I would have been up there. Here's the thing, though. I'll say this. I hold the record that anyone can participate next year. You got to do it at least once. You have an hour and a half to drink a bottle of wine and eat a medium popcorn chicken, and then you run a 6K after an hour.
That's the real challenge. That's the real ATT challenge.
You're going to make it every
Holy
single
shit.
Fan shit their pants. Anybody that competes, they're going to shit their pants like you
I didn't,
did.
I didn't shit my pants. I puked.
You had to shut it down. You had to shit
I didn't
your
have
pants.
To shut it down.
You called me.
Dan, do you know what I did though? When I got up, so I ran like a 1.5 because I need your head by 200 meters. So I ran a 1.5 at 11:45. It took me to like 11:55. I logged it and I kept running because I thought maybe you had like a
sneak
attack.
Yeah, I know. That's why you logged too, because I figured you kept that extra one. I knew that's what you were doing. Like, I knew you were going to load up one more.
I thought you had a sneak attack waiting for 11:59. I was like, oh, this motherfucker. So I had
nope,
I ran
I knew
another
exactly what I said I was going to do. I said I'd do 20 kilometers.
I ran another 0.5 at 11:58 and I logged it at the very end.
Nope. No tricks. Not in that stuff.
So I was playing Brayden's game, the late run, the micro run. Anyways, it felt good to run that much. Am I going to keep running? No.
I'm not going to keep running to that extent.
No, no chance.
It's my fault. I could have 100% said, let's just load up our last runs at the same time. I could have said that. I can't say that anybody cheated because there were no rules. So like, so, you know,
well, Dan,
no
Dan didn't log a run for the first 21 days. Let's also remember that. So,
yeah.
Oh, I did log runs.
No, you didn't. You didn't show
runs. Mystery runs.
Mystery runs.
Anyways, so Monday. How about these aliens that are up in space?
Forget
and all
fucking
the spaceships
aliens.
And planets and all that stuff. Let's maybe
it's
talk
a cool,
about that kind of stuff.
That's a strange day where we have Andrew saying
talk
he wants to talk
aliens.
About aliens.
Let's go.
It was a good month, everyone. I look forward to next month or next year. I really, for the third annual one, I would love to see if we can partner with someone to, you know, maybe we can do something charitable with our running or...
Run for charity.
Yeah, or do something. I'm not sure what, but, you know, if we can double the numbers for next year, that'd be cool. And see if we can, I know it was posted halfway through that like Terry Fox started his run in April. So maybe we could do something with the Terry Fox Foundation. I don't know. We'll think about something. If you have ideas or charities or something, or, you know, groups or something you could put us in contact with for next year's running challenge, let us know. Any ideas and stuff, shoot us. We want to do a little more planning this year. Because again, I said this last year, what would be super fun is if the next year, if everything's free and good, we go somewhere and we run the last day together with fans. We do like a ATT 5K in LA or something.
We'll see. Right?
We run the
5K through Skid Row.
Through Skid Row.
Yeah, Skid Row. Full sprint.
Right past the Cecil Hotel.
Don't slow down.
All right. Anyways, let's get into it. Utsuro Bune. Is that how I say it?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Utsuro Bune. Japanese. Utsuro,
yeah. Japanese. Let's get into it. It's an interesting alien case file of the floating ship.
So the Utsuro Bune UFO, and F being for floating, so unidentified floating object, comes from probably the oldest account that we have, or the furthest we can trace it back, is from a book that had been published in 1815 called Oshukuzaki. But the most well-known account of this event, and probably the most detailed, comes from an author named Kyokute Bakin. And he has a book which is titled Stories from the Rabbit Garden. And the Rabbit Garden was this kind of type of salon hosted by him monthly for knowledge seekers, Tenkai, whichever is like, is kind of well-read men of the day. So it was kind of like that. So it's like what we do every week, pretty much.
Yeah.
Right.
It was like alien theorists theorizing.
And rabbit garden.
In 18th century Japan. Or 17th. The theory is that this account came from secondhand from these people, because they had a very, during these discussions and these gatherings, you'd usually have a concentration on things of really like the occult. So it was kind of like the spiritualist kind of boom during like the early 1900s that you saw in the Western world, in Europe and America and things like that. And they would swipe these accounts of, you know, legends and strange stories and things like that, as you would do probably if you're getting drunk with a bunch of fucking eggheads and shit. So I mean, yeah, what else do you do? Now, this one is known, the Kyokite account is unusual for being so specific, because it was actually written down 22 years after the incident actually occurred. So on the 22nd of February, 1803 is when the event actually occurred. And this is when a strange object that seemed to be some type of small boat or sea craft was spotted off the shore.
I'm still flabbergasted because unusually specific. That's like me now detailing the accounts of my 10th birthday. I have no fucking idea.
Oh, you don't? Yeah, 22 years after the fact of like
10 years.
That's a whole lot of fucking telephone game played within that time period.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, I'm like, okay, 10 years. I'm like, oh, man, that's a tough one. But I guess if this is now a super unusual story, because I bet I have stories of like shit that happened to me 22 years ago that I can remember and retell, because they're very unusual.
Every time
unusual.
You tell it gets a little bit more.
Yeah, but that's with any story I tell.
Exactly.
That's every. Yeah, that's just a Braden story. Gets more grandiose the more times he tells it.
Yeah.
So this object was spotted off the shore of Tsuruhama, which is in the Hitachi province on the eastern coast of Japan. And it was a fishing village of some type. And these, fishermen and fisherfolk rowed out to meet this object as it was coming in with kind of floating out, bobbing out in the surf, and they managed to tow it in. Now they have rather exact measurements, or pretty much like
pretty close
specific measurements of what this thing looked like. So they said that this vessel measured about 3.3 meters tall and about 5.45 meters wide.
So I found that very interesting, because I was like, well, how the fuck did they know? Like, what, how were they, you, they were, you, they weren't using the metric system. But apparently the Japanese, like at this time, had their own measuring system, and that's these numbers converted into metric.
Yeah. It's right. The translation is basically where it gets to this.
Right. Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. When I was like, oh shit, they were smart. Smart of me. I'd be like, I'm just holding my arms out. I'm holding my arms out still this big.
The shape of the vessel was described as being quite round, similar to a ball, but also perhaps resembling more closely a covered incense burner, if you've ever seen one of those. So if you've seen a covered incense burner, I'm probably sure most of our fans probably own at least one. And it's like a tiny... It's like it looks like a flying saucer. Like, so I mean,
sweet things that they swing around at Catholic church.
No, not one of those. Oh,
okay, yeah, then.
Not one of those. It's probably like one of the smaller ones. That's like, you know, it has a
But it's the same idea.
Same idea.
It's just a bigger one.
That's a good. That's a good visualization. Now I'm getting it.
I just googled incense burners and
you get a bunch of dragons.
You get a lot of shapes.
Yeah. So one of the round, most of the times when you see it, because the accounts, the original accounts, what we have from the earliest book that was written or published, the one that was published in 1815, was like actually like a single page story about this event, was accompanied with the drawing. And when I look at it, it looks like two rice bowls like put on top of each other. Like that's pretty much what they drew it or they represented it as. Now, the top half seemed... Andrew's got a picture of it there. He's holding it up to the screen.
Did you draw that? Oh,
and right. There's a lot of pictures of it, but if you look at it, like, that's how...
Oh, that's a fucking UFO.
On top of each other.
It looks like a craft. Looked like a really deep UFO. Like, usually, like, more of a, like, a skinnier saucer, but in these depictions, it's like a... It's much deeper.
Okay.
If you've seen The Flight of the Navigator, that's what it looks like.
It looks like a fucking recovery capsule of a fucking rocket coming back.
Oh, shit. Yeah, kind of.
I didn't think of that before. And then when you pulled up that picture, only because I was, some space news we're going to talk about later, it kind of made me think of that. Kind of looks similar to that.
How do you know we're going to be talking about space news?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I'm saying if we do.
Oh, okay.
There's usually a high percentage, so he's probably not wrong. Like 75% right.
That's fair.
Now, the top half of this craft was described as looking like something made of red lacquered rosewood. And it actually, one of the stranger things that they remarked as having like these small cutout square panels that actually had windows.
Windows, yeah.
And they seem to be patterned like folding screens is what they're described as. And then they just, instead of having... you know, the paper, like a folding screen, it was actually just glass panels.
Which is interesting because they really didn't have the ability to work glass like that, I'd imagine, back in the 1800s.
Well, extremely, it was pretty rare.
It was like a very, now, glass was like a very, like, specialized trade. Like, they had it in churches and stuff, but it wasn't like a common, was it a common
thing? You weren't putting it on fucking floating boats.
No,
it wasn't in popular use in Japanese shipbuilding at that time.
Was that not eloquent enough for you?
Andrew really liked that one. He's fucking lost it.
You weren't putting on floating boats. I don't know why that was so funny, but it was great.
The reaction was funny enough for me.
Yeah, you're right. We probably weren't.
The whole craft was sealed watertight, so the water wasn't getting inside, and the bottom of the vessel seemed to be bound in what they described as some type of metal.
Yeah, like metal sheeted in metal or something.
And now, the craft itself was strange, but the people were even more surprised when the top of the craft actually seemed to swing open as it appeared to be hinged by some kind of latch or mechanism. And then inside of the craft, there was a woman.
A babe.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what the description goes on to describe.
She's a babe. She's a floating babe.
I mean, I don't think that, well, I'm not sure. In my research, I came across, tried to be a little bit more objective, but I don't know what their ideal of like I didn't have her described as beautiful, but the description that they do.
As soon as that lid popped, everybody's like sugoi. Like,
yeah. Great. She was described as having.
I just died in your arms tonight. It must have been, something you said. I just died in your arms tonight.
I feel like the girl would look something kind of like this.
Oh yeah, 100%
Multipass.
Yeah. Multipass.
Maybe
big bada boom.
Maybe with more of a dress and less of a garment strands covering her body.
Well, see, and that's one thing I found interesting about this is that like all the descriptions of her is like a good looking, pale skin,
pinkish skin,
very red hair with like white extensions.
She had a weave.
Yeah. And then, and some weird fabric clothes that they've never seen before. But then you look at the drawings and I'm like, that's a Japanese woman. That you just drew.
Well, but that's how they drew them back then. Like I think they drew everybody like that.
Why did they give her red hair in the pictures when they drew her?
Well, they probably, I think red ink was probably really expensive.
They had it on her outfit.
Yeah, but you don't want to draw like a whole hair of red. Like that's a lot of red ink.
That's a big red budget.
You know what? None of these dudes could probably draw. So when they went back to the fucking police station and gave to the sketch artist, that's what they came up with.
That's what they got.
Yeah.
Like Brayden said, she was described as having pale pink skin of some type. Her hair was extraordinarily red, long, hanging down to at least probably like the middle of her back. And it had some type of strips of white or animal fur, was said. Some kind of fabric
weaved into her hair, like kind of like an extension or something.
Mm-hmm. And there was also talk and there's also mention of a powder that covered these extensions, and they described it as being fine, almost like flour of some type. Brayden also mentioned that she had a dress on that was made of some strange material and also some strange fashion that nobody had ever seen before. And the women who did see it were actually quite interested. They described it as being kind of like tight on the top, I think, and loose on the bottom. And they just didn't know how they had done that or how that they'd never seen something.
Honestly, though, this is like a fish village. So in my head, I was like, Japan at this time is like excommunicado from the rest of the world.
Yeah, right. They got that Sakaku fucking. Yeah,
so it's not like this is like a random small town fishing village that isn't getting a lot of action anyways. So it's like, I imagine anyone from the outside world that would come in and be like, whoa, what are they wearing?
Well, just to elaborate on that a little bit more, though, like between the 17th and the 19th century, Japan adopted this policy, which basically isolated the entire country from the outside world. People weren't allowed to come in. People weren't allowed to leave. So like Brayden's saying, anyone coming from a different country would look absolutely fucking bizarre.
Yeah, right. I think their only real Western trading partner at the time was the Netherlands. So it's like only in the really metropolitan areas, like you weren't like the capitals and things like that. You weren't going to really see anything of Western influence outside of those countries. And
listen, I'm not saying that like the fish folk on the islands were uneducated in 1800s, but
the fish folk
we're talking like mermen and merwomen,
right? The fishermen. Mermen. I'm not fishermen. No. Education, but I'm saying the fisher folk in 1800 were uneducated people. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't a job that like you would go and get an education and like of status. Like, you know what I want to do?
Fish folk.
Move to a rural village and fish with the fish. Yeah, folk.
I mean those fisher folk were probably just they were not as worldly as a person who had lived in a capital.
Is that what you call them? Like that. Fisher folk.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Yeah. Really? Fisher folk.
Fisher folk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fishermen, fisherwomen, fisher folk.
Yeah, there could be fisherwomen, and folk is a gender neutral term. Like,
I guess I don't know. Fisher folk. I didn't know that was a.
What would you rather, fisher people?
Sure.
Fisher folk rolls off the tongue better. I like it.
The fishing community.
The fisher folk.
Her height was measured at about 1.5 meters, and she carried some type of square box.
1.5 meters. So she's tiny.
Yeah,
she's like under 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
Right. She didn't speak Japanese. They said she spoke in a type of language that they were not familiar with, the villagers, but in like 17th century. Where are you gonna, in a rural Japanese village in the 1800s, I'm sure you probably haven't heard a lot of foreign languages. So
listen, this girl's lucky she landed in Japan here with these fisher folk, because from what I know about history, it's not kind to random women showing up in other parts of the world. This could have taken a terrible turn anywhere else.
Turn for the worst.
And one of the other very interesting parts is, like I quickly mentioned before, there is the matter of the square box that she was carrying with her.
What's in the box?
It was like a 2-foot square box, like a fairly large box. So she's just a small girl is clinging onto this box, it seems.
And she wouldn't let anyone, touch it.
It's pretty obvious. We all know what the fuck's in the box.
What's in the box?
We know what's in the box. There's a common theme to the last three case files. What do you think's in this box? We had a fucking blasting rod. We had Aaron's rod. Where are we? We're in Hitachi. This is the first generation Hitachi magic wand. Switch is not letting anybody have it, man. That's what's going on. Not letting anybody have that thing. It's good as gold.
What's the Hitachi's magic wand's powers?
She has an intimate connection with personal massager.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hitachi magic massaging wand. Yes, that's right. Yes, this must be the first iteration.
No wonder. Job done.
Right. Every girl's best friend. No wonder she wouldn't let it out of her sight.
They're watching an intergalactic TV ad for the fucking Hitachi magic wand. That's all it is. That's where the story comes from.
It is peculiar that she no one knows what's in it, because she would not let anyone touch it.
Iron grip.
She was under direct possession of it the entire time.
Yeah. Even if, what do you, like, anything valuable, she's not going to be like, hey, yo, you want to check out this fucking box? You want to see all my worldly belongings that are in this box? All these random people that could take this shit from me whenever they want? Of course she's holding that tight, man. Like,
even though they didn't get a glance inside the box, the villagers did manage to check the interior of this mysterious ship. And inside, they observed things like it seemed to be, at least like the bottom of it was covered in these two sheets of some sort of carpeting, which was softer than anything they had felt before. So some sort of manufactured material. There were two small containers of water, which are described as being perhaps insufficient for actual survival, so that there's no way that she could have been on a long voyage inside this ship. And they were kind of, there's theories being thrown around that perhaps the ship had some way to have manufactured its own fresh water.
It had a desalinator on board. That's what I'm saying. The very first desalinator was on board this ship.
Even like you're saying that she might not have had sufficient like water to, you know, make it a long voyage. That fucking boat wasn't shaped to go on a long voyage either. That thing couldn't have made it across the fucking sea.
It was like, they said it was watertight top. It was like fully sealed. So if the hatch was closed, maybe it just bobs. It just bobbed around the ocean. There was no way you could sink it. It was airtight.
Yeah. I mean, there's maybe no means of propulsion that
they could see.
Fisher folk were familiar with, at least,
that we know
they observed.
Well, at this time, we're at what, early 1803 or whatever? Mm-hmm. There's no steamships yet, is there?
1803? I think we're still on.
Listen,
the fisher folk
don't know about steamships.
Yeah, it's all hand
still
power.
Are we still stuck on fisher folk?
It's fisher
folk. Individuals.
Individuals. They're
individuals.
Individuals.
Okay. You guys passed on that, and I was really disappointed.
No idea.
I thought it was pretty smart.
I'm on board with individuals. I like
Thank
that.
Thank you.
So wait, now, so they said the villagers went aboard the ship, and they, what's with the carpet? They said the softest carpet. Right.
They poked around on it, and they said they had there's some sort of material that was lining the ship, or lining this boat or this craft or whatever, and it seemed to be softer than anything they had ever felt before. Which I could also be like, that's probably a lot of things, because if you're living in a rural fishing village,
if you're an individual,
individuals don't know a lot of
things. Got a sweet shag carpet in it. It's probably got a little fucking disco ball hanging from their UV.
Well, some guy's like, perfect. This bitch has got cake.
So you're saying this ship had furry walls?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, and she had cake.
She's smoking a Jeffrey.
I wonder if life slipped her a Jeffrey. Stroke a furry wall. Happens, man.
Does happen.
It's fuzzy furry walls. God. Another point that stood out is that inside they found some type of strange writing etched into the walls. So writing that was unfamiliar to them, and they couldn't identify what it was.
Hieroglyphs.
Perhaps, yeah. Some people have mentioned that some type of hieroglyphics, perhaps. Or
did you guys see the pictures of the symbols?
No.
I don't know if they have actual pictures.
I couldn't actually find
it. I have the pictures of it.
Hold them up.
Let's get it.
Is it cool? Well, I'll talk about what I noticed when I saw them, but.
So those ones in the middle there, looks like runes.
Right there. Wow, this is awkward.
No,
right there.
I see it. Yeah. I see them. Yeah.
So, you know, what's cool about that, though, is if you compare it to the symbols that were found at the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Right, on the craft.
The triangle with the two circles. It's pretty much the exact same fucking symbol.
Ew.
So where did they pull those symbols from? The books, the descriptions in the books or the stories or?
Yeah. Well, it's the original drawing. Apparently this is the original drawing, not the one Zell showed us.
That's the original drawing. And then next to it is
that's where they pulled those symbols from. Because remember it was see-through, right? You could see perfectly through the fucking glass, and that's where they copied the.
Okay, well, the one I showed you is from like the main one, but there's this one as well. So you're saying those are the symbols right there?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's more than a few representations, like pictures of this, like illustrations of this legend.
So there's like a triangle with a circle. There's like a weird, and then there's like, so there's a triangle with one circle, a triangle with two circles, and then two other weird characters.
Right. It looks more like shapes than writing. Like it's, yeah.
The one right there. That's Rendlesham.
So Rendlesham Forest is a triangle with two circles, but the circles are on the opposite side of this one.
In different spots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's kind of crazy.
Pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it? Like 100 years difference though? Like wasn't Rendlesham Forest in like the 1980s?
Yeah. It was like 170 years difference, but
yeah.
Yeah. Well, we all know how good I am at math. So there's that.
Hey, if this was an ET craft, there's no saying that they couldn't use the same symbols for the last 170 years. Why not?
Well, maybe it's just a different, like, it's fucking Star Command and Starfleet. I don't know. Buzz Lightyear and Star Trek nerds.
Two separate factions?
Two separate, yeah. One of them's going to Infinity and Beyond. The other one's going to fucking Japan.
So what else? So when the villagers went into the ship, anything else of noticed? They didn't see any, like, no visible, no controls or wheel or anything that you would normally steer a ship with, right? It was just like a...
Cake.
Yeah, cake and some meat, apparently.
Yeah, I didn't see any descriptions of what would have appeared to have been controls for the ship. There were some what could probably be described as rations or something. They said that there was some type of meat or something that had been bound in string I assume that the lady had been eating. But other than that, I don't think there's any description of anything that resembles a controlling mechanism of any kind.
Like nothing that stands out as like futuristic tech.
No, I mean, there's no description of like, you know, anything emitting lights or levers or anything really mechanical about the whole ship, or at least that the individuals describe in their account.
So, and from like, I was reading different accounts, right? Cause there's like three different main stories, right? And then we're mainly focusing on the fucking rabbit garden one or whatever.
Seems to be most popular. But, yeah.
In another one, they explained that when they like ushered her back onto her ship, they like repaired it for her. They took it apart to have a look and see what like the inner workings of it was and put it back together. So if they did that, they definitely would see some fucking technology. Like they obviously knew what they were working with if they're able to take it apart and put it back together, I'd imagine.
Well, there's like three stories of it, but this one is like, I guess the more of the main story, but it's hard to tell. But yeah, if they could say they did take it apart, then that means it was not.
Couldn't have been that advanced.
Couldn't have been that advanced.
Or perhaps it was just a modular, it's some type of modular craft. So it's like, it comes apart in pieces, but then you can put it back together or easily reassemble it. So it's like, maybe they took it apart, cleaned it, and then put it back together. And they don't understand necessarily how it all works, but they just put it back together and right. what they thought it was. I mean, nobody ever got to look inside the box. Maybe inside the box is the actual control mechanism for the craft itself.
Or the power source.
That's the power source in the box.
In the box.
Well, also, every old man in the village just wanted to get a stick and push her back out to sea. They're like, let's not deal with this. This is too much for us. Let's get her back out there.
It's a foreigner. If this is really, like we talked about that, I'm butchering the fucking translation. The Sakoku or whatever that, you know, they're basically on isolation on this island. Any like leaving or going or like, I'm sure fraternizing with fucking new people would probably be punishable by death. Right. So they're probably like, you need to get the fuck.
Yeah. There is some mention of suspicion of her perhaps being a spy or something like that from a different country or thing. So yeah, there was a lot of a very prominent isolationist attitude at the time. Yeah.
So if anything, that's probably the nicest thing they could do is be like, all right, kick rocks. Well, see you later.
Yeah, most of the time I think this account, they count because like we've already mentioned, there are probably more than a few versions of this story. The story is relatively popular. It popped up in a couple of publications at the time or between the time that it happened. So that 22 years, it's popped up in a couple of things. And the actual story itself became popularized and you know, in the culture of Japan. So you see it popping up in other places, actually. So, yeah, sending her off is probably the most popular ending to the story, is that they just kind of packed her up and like, okay, whoop.
there's different versions of the story, but the ship either washes to shore or they go and like wrangle it to shore. But either way, they pull it in. This girl gets out. She doesn't look anything like... She's not Japanese. She looks foreign.
But they can't talk to her.
They can't communicate. They can't speak with her. So, but in every version of the story, it's them putting her back on the ship and then just pushing her back to sea.
Yeah.
Get out of here. And they just poke her.
Sayonara.
Just get off the shore. I mean,
I guess, what
do you do in that? So if you're like complete closed off, you're completely nationalist, like it's Japan only, the rest of the world doesn't really exist to you. You don't want to exist.
I mean, it was pretty much like national edict at that point. That like, we're not going to have any contact with the outside world at this point or any of the Western world. So their only trading partner was, or only Western European trading partner was the Netherlands. That was it. Like, that's all you pretty much got.
If she was a little bit more inconspicuous, not with like fucking red ass hair and a weave and crazy clothes, they could probably like help her blend in and, you know, pull a Milan, maybe get her all hiding and everything will be okay. I understand that that's China, but anyways, you know, like blend her in to make sure, you know, she flies under the radar, but she would stick out like a sore thumb. Like you'd get busted in no time. Yep.
Now, why the Netherlands? Why was that the only trading partner?
I think they're the first ones to really get there.
The first ones to actually sail that far.
Yeah. And then Japan. To make real contact and then be like establish like trading things. Cause I think they were just like, we don't want everybody coming in here and fucking up our economy. Cause there was a period that there was a period after that. Into the 1800s, that's when Japan actually started to open up, like mid 1800s. And then that's when you get a lot of, the Meiji restoration, which was essentially like a renaissance. And that's when they become like, we need to catch up to the outside world. And then you get the stuff like the Tom Cruise movie and that kind of stuff going on. Right. You know, they're bringing in all the technologies and stuff and then put the Japanese spin on a lot of it. So, but previous to this, that it really was like around this time, it was still kind of, nobody ever really had any contact with the Western world or anything beyond that. So,
right now there's some theories on what this floating craft could be, this unidentified floating craft that we're going to get to immediately after we refill some beers, and we'll be right back.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hi, I'm Eric.
And I'm Mark, and we're the hosts of Lorehammer, a Warhammer 40K podcast.
Are you tired of constantly being probed by the Greys? For information, of course.
Sick of the Reptilians spending your tax dollars on their underground cities' roads?
And as for our benevolent space brothers, the Nordic aliens, with their tall bodies and their perfectly cut blonde hair, their blue eyes glistening in the sun, their muscles...
Whoa, Eric, that's rippling. Enough. Oh. Keep it together.
Well, if you're not turned away yet, you should head over to Lorehammer and check out the wonderfully horrific world of Warhammer 40K.
It's chock full of hundreds of alien species, a galaxy full of conflict and never-ending war.
So if you're sick of being taken advantage of by aliens, join us as we talk about humanity kicking ass and grinding up Xeno-civilizations, then shooting their remains into the sun.
The Xenos' only crime? Existence. So that's fun.
In each episode, we try to take a singular topic in the universe and regurgitate it in an easy-to-digest manner.
Yeah, we're gonna mama bird you.
So prepare yourself for hours of nonsensical talk, stupid and pedantic arguments about things that aren't even real, and let's not ever forget, many, many, many alien species.
You can find Lorehammer on Spotify and follow our socials. And remember, in the grim darkness of the far future, there are only two types of aliens. Ones that are dead.
And ones that are about to be dead.
All right, we're back.
Yeah. So you had the, you have this... the strange looking foreign lady holding on to this box, and most of the people have no idea what's going on, but it's said that an elder of the village actually came forth with an idea that perhaps this was a princess of some foreign country, and perhaps this princess had been married but actually took a commoner as a lover. And so as punishment, her father, who had been a king of this foreign country, took her lover's head and chopped it off, put it in a box, put her inside this ship and kicked her off to the ocean. Because that's what you did back then, I guess.
I'm so much happier with that story, though, because for some reason, I thought it was a fucking like a little box filled with like a Voldemort fetus, you know, like the one hanging out of the fuck under the bench on the last Harry Potter. Like,
I find it hilarious that like an elder of the village, because they probably lived through like, you know, probably like 1700s Japan is fucking crazy shit. You got like warlords running around and all this crazy shit going on, and they're like, well, you know, the first thing is it's probably her. Jilted lover's head in a box. I'm like, what the fuck, granddad? It could be just some jewelry or something. Probably something less important. What? You mean like a hand? Like, what? Like, who puts a head in a box and puts him in takes him off to sea? What the fuck?
Yeah, this guy was definitely not taken seriously around the campfire because...
You know... Go ahead.
No, that's all I had to say.
You know why? Yeah, because he's been pitching that exact same fucking screenplay for about 10 years now.
He probably says that about everything. Yeah, he probably says that about everything.
It reminds me of this time that this happened.
No.
It's always somebody's head in a box, too, because he's probably like always saw some kind of executions or something. It's probably just like, that's his frame of reference. It's like, yeah, it's always a head in a box. It was always the early script
for Seven.
Yeah.
That's what it was. That's where they drew,
was in the box.
Drew inspiration.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
I just like to think he's the old man who's like, everything's like a head in a box. Or he's like, oh, that's a bag. Grew up from a buried head back there. Like, what?
Yeah. Something goes missing from the village. He's like, I bet it was 13 individuals put together some sort of crazy heist where they shut down the power and water. They're like, power and water? What the fuck are you talking about?
And then they put Brad Pitt's wife's head in a box.
What? It's like, go ahead, Jimmy. Guess what's inside? What's your present? What's your birthday? What's inside your birthday present?
Oh, probably Freeman. A severed head. Like, what?
Here's a
this is kind of, so obviously there has to be, right?
Like, he's like shaking the box. Sounds like a severed head.
Like, there's albinos of every culture, right? There's gotta be Japanese albinos.
I'm sure.
But they wouldn't,
doesn't,
I mean.
Doesn't account for the fact that she wasn't able to speak Japanese.
Or she had red hair.
Well, yeah, but she had white too. Maybe they just misunderstood, right? Maybe it was kind of like reddish white.
Sure.
Well, no, because they said it was like the white part was extensions. It was artificially added. And
maybe she was trying to hide it. She was trying to fucking dye her hair. Everybody knows when those chicks buy fucking box dye. Never so goes well.
You know what I kind of thought is like, I mean, and this is going to, we're getting sci-fi here. Hang on to your butts. Yeah.
Hang on to your butts.
There's like, you know, because a lot of times when I was reading, people were like, well, it couldn't be a spacecraft because it's not designed to be a spacecraft because it wouldn't, like, part of it was, some of it was wood. Like, it wasn't the best design for entry into atmosphere. And then as I was like reading into it and stuff, it really reminded me of this, like the book Ender's Game. I don't know if anyone's read it, but later on in the series, spoilers alert, they fly in a box essentially that just punches through dimensions. Right. And part of me wondered, like, if this was some sort of like futuristic person from a time and they only had limited supplies because they knew they were only going to have limited, like they weren't going to be around for a while. And, you know, the structure and everything of this tiny craft was made to amplify whatever power was in the box or some meditation that would transport you to punch you through a different dimension or somewhere else, or even somewhere in time. And this lady just happened to do it and was like, holy fuck, I landed in the ocean.
Right? On a different planet. Fucking
in a different planet, or even the same planet, maybe just years in the past or
skip
something.
Time.
And she's just like, okay, yeah, like, and these people are being really friendly. So she's just like playing along. She's just like, yeah, like, all right, she's chilling for a bit. And they push her back out to sea, and then she pieces back to where she was supposed to go. But basically, you have to throw up our concept of like space travel and stuff and just be like, well, maybe this is something that works in a frequency that we don't even understand. And this craft just amplifies whatever power's in this box and just moves you and it through
time and space,
our dimensions as we know it.
Well, that would have to say, like, because they said the top half was made of rosewood.
Yeah.
But appeared to be rosewood.
Dude, and the box is just filled with different crystals that have been charged in a full moon.
Well, that's what I mean. If it appeared to be rosewood, maybe it was just like some, like, you know, some weird alloy or something that resembled rosewood, but it was actually super strong and it could, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, like we said, these are individuals. They're fisher folk. They're from a rural fishing village. They would probably, they only have so much frame of reference to lean on. So it's like if they were going to see something that they weren't necessarily familiar with, they would probably just choose whatever description that is closest to what they're familiar with. So it could have been something that, you know, they said it resembled rosewood, but it could perhaps be some type of, I mean, there's plenty of science fiction books where like they use trees or some type of plant.
Space wood, man.
Dude, yeah, they use trees as or plants as spacecraft. Like it's not
legit. It's in Ender's Game, that's what they have what's called a living tree,
right?
And they
Groot,
and they have chopped like an AI that works it, and they literally just punch the object and themselves through time and space, right?
That's pretty
using
dope.
Like Einstein Rosen Bridge.
Yeah.
Right? It was just like boop, they're here, and next they kind of pop into the chaos and they pop back wherever they need to be.
So either this girl's just a foreigner who had a dispute with her husband, and her dad chopped off her head, and
we don't know if it was head. Well, it could have been his hand.
Her lover's foot.
Listen, that doesn't make any sense because she would speak Japanese, and if she was from anywhere further, she didn't have enough supplies to last fucking a voyage. Well,
maybe she did.
That's what makes you wonder if that, like, she's being exiled. So obviously they don't expect her to survive. They're like, here's a little bit to get you going, but you know, how you doing? Keep moving. Fuck off.
Yeah, but where is she coming from?
Russia.
Well, if they dropped her, yeah, they could have dropped her off somewhere like in Russia. If they like popped her off in like Vladivostok,
that's
maybe the
still
currents
a long
would have
journey
her.
And there's no talk of her being
so
like
it's easier
famished.
For you to believe that she's flying in a fucking wooden space cube that they're coming from fucking Russia.
I'm just saying drifting in the current with limited water and stuff. She still had cake. They didn't say rotted cake. They didn't say meat. She had food prepped. Every description of her seems like this open to someone who was like, you know, uncomfortable in a sense where they didn't know where they were or couldn't converse. But there was no, like, she wasn't famished. She wasn't, like, concerned. She had food. She had food that wasn't rotted on there. She had water left. I'm like, dude, you're just floating in the fucking Pacific Ocean from Russia to Japan.
Well, if you look at the world map, though,
that current is taking you. Yeah, okay. Well, if we zoom out, it looks real close together, but it's pretty far.
Yeah, but I'm saying how far of a float? If you look at the north end of Japan and like there's like a Russian island, I can't read. Obviously, cannot read it.
Well, it's like if the place that we're talking about or where the events described to have taken place is like on the eastern coast of Japan there. So it's like midway down.
So we're like 1,000 kilometers from Russia or so.
Yes.
Probably.
I'm not looking at a map, but
I'm looking at a map right now. And judging by the legend, it looks from the closest point of Russia is about 1,000 K, which is pretty far. So you would need ample supplies to be able to drift that far.
Okay. Sure. All right. So she didn't come from Russia. What if she came from Atlantis?
From Atlantis.
So this is another theory that some people go
on. She came with Atlantis.
Atlantis or Atlantis? One of the other sunken cities could be perhaps that the one of the other theories that Mu is thrown Lemuria? Out there as well. What? Was it Lemuria? Yeah.
Lemuria Mu, could possibly. Atlantis?
Yeah. One of those.
So this is just the story of sunken Ariel? Cities.
I mean, it sounds like it.
Red
She's
hair.
Got red hair.
She wants to go where the people go.
Yeah.
Right? Shining.
Dinglehoppers, man. Dinglehoppers.
Yeah. I'm not going to start saying it.
You should have. I was waiting. Cue it up.
I guess Japan has its own kind of long history of things that perhaps seem a little bit strange or could even point towards extraterrestrial intervention of some type.
Oh, for sure.
So either an alien culture, or perhaps even like if we talk about Atlantis or Mu, which is theorized to be located somewhere. I think Lemuria is more supposed to be somewhere in the Indian Ocean. I think Mu is probably perhaps more in the Pacific Ocean. So probably
those were the three kingdoms, the three warring kingdoms from like the lore of like they were actually at all at battle or something.
Mm-hmm.
Atlantis, Mu, and Lemuria.
Yeah. And if she perhaps came from one of those cultures, there are stories in Japan that could possibly point that way as well. So you have these things called dogu. I don't know if Zell, you want to pull those up, but they're these small clay figures, which are mysterious in origin. I mean, they know where they're from, but they don't know exactly like why these people made them and why they decorated them or designed them the way that they did. But if you look at these figures, a lot of the ones that the more popular ones,
they're little ETs.
Iconic ones.
Oh man, they look like putties.
Look at those fucking things. Bastards. If you're not watching, you're just listening. They are little figurines shaped. Some of them look like they're wearing like almost like, you know, space helmets.
Right. I think they call, I don't remember the exact name for it, but that like they call them like goggle eyed, like literally the translation is like it's like shokaku something, like it's Chicago. The goggled eyed figurines.
Yeah,
and it's like they wear it looks like they're wearing some type of like, you know, like sunglasses or visors of some type. They have they have all these kind of like details and stuff on them that resemble spacesuits. Like it could very much be interpreted that way.
They look futuristic for sure.
And there are hundreds of these figures. There are some figures that are more they're more intricate than others, but a lot of the ones that you see kind of out there that are described as kind of the typical examples of these figures, the ones that look very much like what you could perhaps see like somebody wearing a spacesuit.
Yeah, so they look like they're wearing futuristic clothing. So where's the inspiration for those dogus?
Yeah, and these dogus are old. They are archaeologists have dated them from the Jomon period, of Japanese prehistoric Japanese history. So that's somewhere between, that's between like 14,000 and 400 BC, which is a big range, but it's still like it's ancient Japan.
Mm-hmm. That's well before, you know, well before modern history. And these things have been around for that long. I mean, even like even Japan itself, the goddess is the goddess. That's like, what's the religion? Shinto in Japan, mm-hmm. the main religion, or at least used right. to be
as one of the more popular religions, at least that was the dominant religion for a long time.
Their goddess was Amaterasu, which is like the
Amaterasu.
Yeah. Amaterasu. Mm-hmm. So like, that's like the sun goddess. Like then that's even on their flag now, like the rising sun is like, that's still based on this like central theme of like this god came down and the first emperor of
Japan
claimed to be descended from the goddess, you know?
Right.
So like, I mean, as far as many, many religions, like there's always like, you know, something that comes from the sky, like a goddess, a deity. So like in Japan, you have this goddess and you have all these figures. So a lot of people say like, I would say a lot of people, but some people say, if you dig through the internet, that maybe whatever this being was that came in the ship was maybe, you know, like a goddess or something, like an alien coming back just to do a quick check-in, you know, not looking too conspicuous.
Japan has a rich and complex folklore and history that a lot of it, if you go back and examine it through the lens of perhaps the theory of some of these things were perhaps extraterrestrial. I think one of the best examples is probably the Japanese tengu. And if you know the tengu, it's a type of yokai, the word for kind of supernatural being that's Japanese use. And it is the typical one is kind of it's pretty much a humanoid figure. So you have like a, you know, two arms, two legs, head, whatever. And then it also has like bird-like wings. And in the older versions of the descriptions, you have it has like a beak, so it's very much like a bird person, you know, bird man, if you will.
I like bird person.
A bird person. A bird individual.
If you will. I like that. Here we go.
Bringing around. And if I were to go back and be like, okay, this is if you wanted to be like, okay, I'm looking for perhaps clues, or I'm looking for examples of legends that could be critically examined to be like, okay, maybe this is perhaps some actual evidence of extraterrestrial contact. Like a tengu would be my go-to for Japanese, because you have these creatures that they're flying. They're able to fly. They have the power of flight.
Right.
You wouldn't be able to really describe anything back then flying without wings. And also there's also a common theme in a lot of tengu legends where that these tengu were actually accompanied by events in the sky. So you had either shooting stars or objects moving through the sky, and you would have these tengu appear, you know, either before or after these celestial events. So when I look at it, if I looked at it with the idea to be like, these were perhaps extraterrestrials, I'd be like, well, maybe that beak is actually some sort of mouth covering or something like that.
Mask?
Some type of mask, a breathing apparatus of some type.
Some type of regulator. Yeah.
Yeah. And so these shooting stars or these celestial events are not just things, meteorites or meteors or things like that. It's actually perhaps a craft coming to pick them up or some type of transport. They're able to fly. They're able to they interact with people, but not to like such an extent that people are like, I want to see one on a daily basis, but they're considered some type of supernatural being with supernatural powers. So I would put my money on, to be like, if there are extraterrestrials that were being described as in legend as supernatural creatures, I'd be like, the tengu. It's like,
yeah, I mean, they sound like it at least, right?
Yeah,
as far as description wise. Now, as far like Japan is, and there's a lot of lore and stuff we could go through, but so we got to keep it short tonight. But there's this one like granite stone that's carved there. I don't want to try and pronounce it because I'm going to butcher it. Dan, you know what it is? It's starts with the M.
The Masuda no Iwafune.
Masuda no Iwafune. It's it translates, the Masuda is the region, but it translates, so the region, the rock ship of that region is the Iwafune rock ship.
Iwafune
It translates to rock ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
sounds awesome.
It is a brilliantly carved or ingeniously carved megalithic structure. Like, it seems to be a carved of one piece of stone, at least as far as I know.
And it looks so fucking out of place,
dude. It's like in the middle of this region, a gigantic, like, well, I think it's like 600 ton pure granite stone carved, and like archaeologists and stuff say it's some type of tomb. Obviously, it's so old that they never found any bodies in it, but it like, oh, it must have been carved for a tomb is what they say. But this is what it looks like. If just listening and not watching, it looks like a fucking spaceship, but it's a rock.
It does, 100%. Right? And that's why I'm like, even cool. If we go with the other craft or the other, you know, unidentified floating object, if we throw out our notion of what we think these things have to be, it's like, if this just has to be some sort of chamber where you can power something that moves you and this object through space and time, maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, these metal ships and stuff that we think. It can be anything. And maybe that's what this is.
Oh, man. I'm telling you right now, all that thing is missing is a giant eye on the top, and that's like the top of the Technodrome. All you need is a Rokusaki hanging out there. After killing Master Yoshi. Yeah, exactly.
Krang.
Right?
Okay.
So I'm... Got Tatsu hanging out.
Some people say when they're talking about this event that the ship actually, they're very similar. Because if you look at the granite ship, it looks like a craft. It looks like a big saucer, kind of. But obviously it's got stuff cut into the top. Now, I don't really know exactly. I mean, granite is a super hard stone to cut. I mean, it can be cut through diligent process, like you just got hundreds of people working day in, day out. You can eventually cut through granite and carve it out.
Yeah,
but
and I think the right now the most popular or the most accepted theory in academia is that these were probably leftovers or something from, or either like markers for tombs or something like that. But there are no tombs there.
There's no tombs. Like there's bodies. There's no tombs. Like
none at all. And it's either like you could put forth the argument that it's like, okay, you know. In Egypt, right? So you have Egypt that there are probably supposed to be, you know, thousands of tombs on the Nile or where people have been buried. Grave robbers have been over those things for 100, you know, you get a hundred years, thousands of years.
Yeah, but like, Japan's a little different.
Island nation. Yeah.
It's an island nation, like very, very culture and like driven and like respectful people.
You'd probably still have grave robbers.
Yeah, I would.
100%.
But even though, like,
they're still just people. Like,
people are shitty everywhere.
Even if there was grave robbers, like, it's just a stone. Like,
what are you trying to say about Egyptian people, man? Come on now.
Love robbing graves.
Jeez. Yes, please. Egypt vigils.
I saw that on my 23andMe. I'm offended.
What's your percentage of Egyptian?
Not very much.
No,
it's. Just enough to warrant the tattoo. Like 15%. That's it.
Yeah, just enough to be offended by Prince.
Well, our family initially migrated from Egypt from Egypt to Lebanon, so technically we are Egyptian, but I don't know how far back. Who knows?
Who knows?
It's a big purple dot in the Middle East and half of Africa.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
One of the other things, if we want to get into the idea that is perhaps some type of lost civilization or sunken civilization, you don't have to actually go that far to find perhaps what is evidence of some type of submerged
it's bananas
culture. You have what is known as the Yonaguni Monument, and you can look this up on Google Maps. Like, you type in Yonaguni Monument,
it's insane.
I actually tried to plan our trip when I was stationed in Japan. When I was in the Navy, like, I started to plan out a trip to actually go there, but it's actually kind of expensive to get to this place because it's kind of out of the way to get there. But this structure,
submerged word, structure,
was discovered in 1986, and it is a what is described as pretty much a very impressive, like, collection of strangely structured, is it granite?
Let's say what it looks like. At first glance, it looks like a megalithic structure, like a pyramid or a collection of built. At first glance, you're like, this is for sure.
It's a pyramid.
A pyramid of something. Look at this fucking thing.
Right. If you look at pictures, it is like, it is these, the most typical pictures that you'll come across are these submerged stone structures, formations that are cut at impressively regular angles, like stair step, perfect, like 90 degree angles and perfectly smooth, flat. They're extremely, it's astonishing.
Underwater. Like
it's underwater. It is really, really cool.
The monument ranges from like 40 to 100 feet underwater. So it's not that submerged. So if this was a structure, it definitely could have sunk within the last 5 or 7,000 years or even sooner, depending, because it's such a, you know, we're on the Ring of Fire here. So like tectonics are huge. So like a big earthquake could drop something into the water.
Right. And props, one of the people who has been studying this for the longest is probably Masaki Kimura of the University of the Ryukyus. And he had first estimated that this monument was perhaps 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
And he had dated it to that period when this structure would have been above water. But since then, he's still working on his theory about where it is. And he has kind of revised it to be like, perhaps this it's not that old, maybe not 10,000 years, maybe like a couple less. I think maybe he said like
2,000 to 5,000. Like he doesn't,
right.
It's hard to really judge because they have found like tools and pottery, but it's very scarce and far between.
And this thing pops up on other like TV shows a whole bunch. Like you'll see it all
everywhere,
the time.
Man.
And it's actually really cool. Like if you get a chance and you ever want to go somewhere really neat and out of the way, like go there. Apparently it is it's probably one of the best spots in the world, I think, to actually observe hammerhead sharks. This is it's a really weird phenomenon that there is actually weird.
Something's drawing hammerhead sharks there.
Yeah, a lot. Like it is a weird amount of hammerhead sharks.
The fucking hammer on the hammerhead sharks. What's the, they have like that ampullae of Lorenzini, like that extrasensory organ. Mm-hmm. Something in this fucking monument, astronomer.
Perhaps.
Maybe there's a power source there.
That's fucking cool, man.
Dude, so, it's so cool.
The only thing that gets me though is the
sharks
geology.
Are going to this temple and we don't know why they congregate there.
One of the things that really
we should be talking about, that's fucking
rad.
It
is pretty rad.
Well, I'm not a marine biologist, and I don't know much of that. Hammerhead biology.
I'm not an individual, Dan.
Yeah, you're not.
I don't even know why I'm talking about this.
One of the things that really gets me about this is the kind of the argument about whether these things are natural or man-made structures is you have geologist Robert Schock. And if you've ever watched Ancient Aliens, you've seen Robert Schock. He is the guy that he's their geologist that
he's
they
the Sphinx
bring
guy.
In. He's the Sphinx guy. And they bring him in all the time. They brought him in for the Bosnian. He went to the Bosnian pyramids and he told the guy, he's like, these are not man-made.
He's the guy's like, no, these definitely not. There's no way.
Right. I like Robert Schock. I didn't like him at first, but I've come around on Robert Schock. That is like, he's a fringe. He's considered a fringe theorist, but he's also, Yeah, he bases his theories in facts. Like he bases his theories in facts and observations and clinical observations of what he sees. And he's actually been to these and he considers his theory is that these are most likely natural. He wants to go ahead and say that this is something unusual. It is really cool, but there's another thing that people have observed on the actual islands that are above water, closest to the Yonaguni monument, is that you actually see on Yonaguni Island itself and in Okinawa, there appears to be some type of ancient tradition. There's archaeological evidence that of humans modifying and enhancing and improving on nature. So they would So they would carve out from stone and things like this, structures and temples and shrines of that type. So there is a kind of theory that's like, perhaps it's a combination of the two. It's not just natural, but perhaps it was modified. It was originally a natural structure, but then perhaps modified by man when this terrain was above water at some point. But it is huge. Like, it is really big.
Dude, it's 300 meters by 150 meters. Like, it's a, so what's a football field's 100 yards and 100 yards is like 115 meters. So like the, over three football fields long and 1.5 wide. It's when you just Google it, just Google this thing. If you're not watching,
hashtag, look it up.
If you're not watching,
yeah, it's as big, it's at least as big as when people, it's as big as a stadium. Like, is how big this thing is. And there are parts in there that have been described as like, there are structures that seem to be a castle or some type of arch or perhaps temples. There's a lot of like weird
Masaki,
stuff.
Masaki Kimura, he goes into great detail. He says that there is a castle, an arch, five temples, one large stadium, all of which are connected by roads and water canals and are partly shielded by what could be a huge retaining wall. Yeah. So this guy's been diving there for like 25 years. Like,
yeah, he's been at least 15 to 20 years. He's been studying this thing,
dude. And my personal good friend Graham Hancock has also, he wrote a whole book on this. He dove here for like 8 years straight, and he wrote a book on it. Like he's convinced because it does. It looks so man made. It really does. Like at first glance, you look at it, you're like, it does look like the right angles and the canals. It does look man made. But if you start digging in, nature does do crazy shit. Especially
if you look at weathering of unusual, or if you just look up like unusual weathering of granite or sandstone, you'll see that nature has a lot of ways to make things look extremely impressive.
Not so much granite, but definitely
structures.
Definitely sandstone, and we're in like a tectonic region. And so that's what Shock was saying in his analysis, was like, we're in such a tectonic region and under heavy upheaval of the earth, like it can actually crack the sandstone in like right angles and make it look like it was cut.
Yeah.
And he does, if you go look, and he does show examples of other stuff that's similar, but nothing near the scale of this monument.
Right. And one of the other kind of contentions that they held,
there's no way that's natural. That whole thing is natural.
Some people say it is. We've got to say we got to go with all the full encompassing theory. Some people say it is. And some people say there's no chance this is fucking Atlantis.
Right. One of the other people point to as perhaps like indication that these were man-made is that there is no like debris. There's no natural debris around it, or there doesn't seem to be. There's not a lot of like natural chunks broken off or things like that. But then Shock says like, cause this is like, this place is surrounded and like very strong currents go through this area.
Super strong.
That was one of the things that Shock says, like you could, that current could just take that thing right off. Like if there was a chunk, it would take it, it'd be gone, you know?
Well, and they also say like Kimura, the guy's been diving here, says there's like natural etchings or not natural. He claims they are human etchings, but they're been overgrown in like barnacles and whatever else. So, and Shock and others are like, no, that's natural formations from rocks grinding together. But this guy's convinced that this is a art, like a man-made, or at least a man, like it, man helped shape it.
Yeah. I think that is central to his theory that there is perhaps some type of human or.
Because usually in megalithic structures, like you see stacked stone, right? And this does not look, it does look like a piece of stone. It really does. It looks like a giant, like a huge rock that's
been shaped. It's all like, it's just a single piece of stone.
But it looks shaped. It does look shaped. Like it looks like there's tiers and stairs and hallways. And
intelligently carved, you know.
If you dove into this and you'd never seen it before, you'd be like, holy fuck.
I'd lose my fucking mind.
Yeah, it looks fucking crazy. I'd be like,
this is where Cthulhu lives. We need to go right now.
Leave. We're going to awaken some ancient evil.
Yeah, no.
No, thank you.
Yeah, so on that theory, like, say this, like this, it was an unidentified floating object and say it wasn't extraterrestrial and it maybe, you know, just coming to check out it, like some ancient land, like, you know, I've been floating here. Maybe she was diving, checking out Yonaguni, and she just wanted to check what the people are like, you know, on Japan now after it's been thousands and thousands of years. I don't know, but the Yonaguni thing is just, it's mind-boggling when you look at it. I know, I can't get over it. I loved, but they do say like huge currents, so only experienced divers, or you have to go with like one of those, like one of those little torpedo things, like the propellants.
Scooters.
The underwater scooters, so you can get through the current. I don't know, it's pretty cool. Is there any other ET things about that we can kind of link together here? I think that's all.
I think that pretty much covers most of the stuff that
pretty much most of the shit
came across. I mean, anything else we'll probably bring up on a later case files.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like one of the older ones we've got into, right? Like such an old.
Yeah, it's a weird popular legend in Japan that is kind of like, this sounds really, really weird and really, really strange. And it's been picked up in more recent years when, when I talked about the Japanese Tengu, when you go back and with the idea of reinterpreting or critically examining events or legends through the lens of the, you know, perhaps these were extraterrestrial encounters as opposed to some type of supernatural or something like that, then this is one of the ones that kind of strikes you as being like, huh, there might be something there.
Yeah, well, there's weird stuff to it. So it's,
yeah,
you know, makes for an interesting case. I still think it's some sort of fucking, some craft that is just out of our knowledge of someone from the future.
Transcending dimensions.
Transcending dimensions and time and just punch that thing right through time and space. Popped out right on the edge of Japan.
She wasn't Japanese. She came from somewhere else. She didn't speak the language. She had weird runes and symbols engraved on the ship. I mean, the ship is, some people say like, oh, this is definitely a flying, you know, it's a flying saucer. No, it was, there's no evidence that it was flying. It was floating. So it's an unidentified floating object. Maybe it did fly. Maybe after they, you know, all the old,
maybe it crashed in the water.
Maybe it crashed or like it came from, like, cause we always talk about underground submerged bases and stuff like, or underwater bases.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, like, yeah, maybe something happened and she's floating on the surface waiting to get rescued.
Maybe they had an underwater observation post somewhere.
Yeah, and she washes up. She washes up the villagers. They scoop her up. They're like, oh, you know what? She's not from here. We can't have this. They just put her back in, give her some food and just poke her back out to sea where eventually she gets rescued by her ET comrades and off she goes. Right.
Well, maybe the box was her distress beacon. Like maybe that's what it was. And then they came and picked her up.
That is one of the mysteries still is what's in the box. I mean,
what's in the box?
What's in the box?
No idea.
Andrew, what do you think?
I like the time travel idea. I think that's pretty neat. But mostly I think it's just a fairy tale. I think it's a story that's been passed down from individuals to other individuals throughout the last 22 years before the book was written. I think the story got a little bit more grandiose and exciting and more elaborate. And that's kind of my take on it. I like the idea of, like, it makes sense to me that this woman was exiled for whatever reason. I buy that, but I don't know. It was cool. It was fun to theorize on.
From where? Where would she be exiled from?
From whatever country that she's from initially. I don't understand why that's so hard to fathom.
Because it would be such a long trip floating.
Okay. And?
She had food.
Okay. We didn't get into extreme detail on everything. It was cake. Maybe it was rotten. Maybe it wasn't. Who knows? Maybe it was some type of fucking cake that was made to preserve. Like when you say cake, that's translation from fucking Japanese. We don't know exactly what it was.
It's true. I mean,
cake could have been some type of fucking jerky and some type of rice cake that could be dehydrated or some shit. Who knows?
Cake's full of sugar. I mean, it can last a long time.
Yeah. Like I don't understand why that's such a huge sticking point, but all right.
Anyways, this is one that actually it's not a very well documented case. Like there's not a lot of podcasts or videos or there's not a ton of research on it. It's kind of like a, It is more of like, it's folklore.
It's a fairy tale.
But, well, but connected to
just,
the rest
maybe
of the stuff.
Maybe it's just a piece of a bigger puzzle.
Yeah, so. Connected to all the other stuff in Japan, like, you know, maybe. Maybe it's, but it, yeah, it was fun to get into. Something a little
connect
different.
Connect the dots, people.
Connect it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Get in there. Look it up. All right. Here we go. I got Randomatron coming up. Space news.
Couple space news. First off, if you live anywhere on Earth, there's a small chance you might die in the coming days, and it's all thanks to China.
Thanks, China.
I'm calling it the death lottery.
Well, your chances of dying are higher than normal.
Are normal. Well, it's not every day there's a chance of a 21-ton core stage of a rocket is going to smash into you. Recently, China launched the Long March 5B Y2 rocket into space, and it carried its first space station module into orbit. The launch was an absolute success, except for one problem. The 21-ton core stage of the rocket drifted into orbit instead of falling back to Earth.
It's in low Earth orbit. Yeah.
Now it's in low Earth orbit, and it's scheduled to make an uncontrolled reentry into the Earth's atmosphere over the next few days. They don't know where, they don't know when, but this thing's coming down. Their hopes are it comes down in the water, you know? But SpaceX had an uncontrolled reentry a couple months ago, and people thought it was UFOs coming and attacking. It was a spectacular display, and some debris landed in a farmer's field. No one was injured. This thing is a lot bigger.
It's the biggest uncontrolled reentry of a spacecraft of all time.
Yeah. So, like I said, keep those eyes on the skies because it might be your last.
They're saying it's probably going to burn up more or less and reentry, but small fragments may still rain randomly across the fucking Earth.
So there's a higher chance than normal that you'll be smashed with a space debris.
Yeah.
And they're like, as part of like the space pact, like no one's supposed to do this. You're supposed to control your descent. And now this has happened twice now to the same lifter. So like, China, come on, you know, at least plan it a little better.
Take your umbrellas when you go out, folks. Just,
Yeah, so good. It's a very, very small chance, but we're saying there's a chance that someone may be struck by the stray space 21 debris.
21-ton fuselage.
So heads up, East Coast, USA, all the way over.
I think if it smacked into your front yard, you'd probably make some bank, though. You'd probably get some compensation. I mean,
that's my yard. That's my property now. I'm keeping
it. It's mine now.
Yeah.
I own it.
Don't you dare come here.
Zelzy eating a chunk.
First thing I'm doing is biting a piece off the wing. Other space news we got to talk about. Four astronauts landed back safely in the middle of the night off the Crew Dragon for the first time.
Woo!
Dragon.
Launched it up on a used lifter, brought them back in the capsule. Private space, man, is exploding. So it's cool stuff is happening. It's not just NASA anymore. Got a bunch of companies on the up.
Yeah, private companies just like sending people up and down from space. Like, fuck, it's cool.
Yeah.
Sweet.
It was a pretty quick descent too. It was like 8:35 PM, May 1st. They launched, and 2:56 AM on May 2nd, they landed in the Gulf by Panama City.
Well, not just that, but I remember I watched the video of when like the new crew, like the crew got on the ISS or whatever, when they came out of the pod and they came out of the craft, and this like it struck me as really funny that everybody wears, they have like space khakis.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the, is this like your formal wear? It's like, you got these, they got these like space khaki pants that they wear. I'm like, dude, I would wear a jumpsuit. Like when I was in the Navy, I wore a fucking, it's like, you just wear your overalls like 24/7. Like, I don't know. It's like you have space khakis on and they got little belts and stuff. And I'm like, how are you not just wearing sweatpants like all the time? Yeah, I thought that was really funny. It's like, oh man, somebody had to design space khakis, like zero G khakis.
There's a job for everybody. Someone's got to do it.
Whatever.
That's it for space news. Let's wrap this up. We've been going a little longer. The meat draw is coming up. Anyone for April, if you're a $10 tier or more on Patreon, you'll be entered. And because we did post it on Instagram, it's if you ran 50 kilometers or more in the running challenge, your name's entered to win the meat draw. So stand by for that. And we also have to determine what our prizes for
the meat draw winners. I think, yeah, what did we do last year? 3 or 5? We're going to talk about more in after hours and we'll announce more on the next case file. But before we read some new Patreons, we got to give a theorite of the week. I believe he's now a two-time.
Two-time.
It was posted two-time earlier. Freewheeling Seth Cornelly bought him and his two kids ATT t-shirts, took a picture.
You started early, man.
Also, this is the guy who asked us early on in the podcast if he could use our logo for his jump jersey for skydiving.
Nice. That's right. And
that's when he won it the first time, and now he's got his kids on the show. I don't know if they're listening to the show, but he's got him a t-shirt at least. Don't. So maybe you shouldn't let your kids
sharp, boys.
Don't let your kids listen to the show till they're at least 16.
Yeah,
just in case. But Seth Cornelly, theorite of the week, 2-time. We appreciate it, brother. All right, and if you're not supporting the show already, you want access to the live stream, early access to the shows on all the bonus goodies, head over to patreon.com/alientheoristpodcast or just find the link in the podcast description. All right. This week's theorites of the... Fuck, idiot. This week's Patreon supporters are Spicoli, a top tier pledge by Hayden. Thank you very much.
Woo-hoo.
Mush Life, Sheila, Ram to Hall, Austin Kipp, Brandon Gibson, Zach, Eduardo Guerrera, and Mike Hunt. Thank you very much for supporting the show. If you got any questions on how it works, please reach out and let us know.
What was that last name?
Mike Hunt.
Mike Hunt.
Mike Hunt.
Got it.
Yeah, perfect.
What nice. Do you think? Mike Hunt?
Nothing.
No nothing. Seymour Butts this week?
No IP release.
Keep those eyes on the sky.
Right, Amanda hug and kiss.
Hey.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.